And we have the sadhu question for this evening. So here comes the first question. Dear Ajahn, after the grand lunch today, I started nodding off during meditation. You have a lot of lunch there, but you don't have to eat it all. So I'd be tempted and you asked there. After grand lunch today, I started nodding off during meditation, so I went to my room. Lying down, I just could not sleep. It was not due to the yak, yak, yak that I'm used to. On the contrary, everything inside my head was silent, as if my body was zombie, filled with mental energy. So I went back to the hall to meditate and started to nod off. Please advise this confused one. Okay. So if you nod off in the hall and you're wide awake in your hut, try middle way on the stupa. So somewhere in between your hut and your this place over here, you just get the right amount of energy, and especially if you sit right on the edge of the stupa, you won't nod off. There used to be this monastery in Laos before the communists took over. And it was an amazing forest monastery, reputed to have these great meditation masters. And this is how they got these great meditation masters. The abbot, the teacher, he used to take the new meditators on a walk through the jungle, up and down these mountains, you know, in Laos, and take them for a walk all day, so they're really tired and sweaty. And he'd always manage to get back to this place in the jungle, not far from the monastery, where they had these incredible, beautiful, tall trees. And the monks had built these platforms on top of the branches. They were just the size of your meditation mats, with no railings around there, and a ladder going up. And these exhausted monks were told to climb that ladder and sit on this little platform high up in the trees with nothing stopping them, no safety railings. And then the abbot would take the ladder away and say, I'll be back tomorrow morning. And so these monks, tired, high up in just a small place, had to sit all night. And if they nodded off, they wouldn't just nod off. They would nod off the tree and go hurtling to their death hundreds of feet below. Many monks got great meditation with that method. Not everyone, but the only ones who told the tale were those who got great meditation. So there you go, the stoop is not that high. You're not going to break anything on that grass. It's so soft. So you can try that on the edge of the grass and see if you nod off. So what happens is sometimes when you're here, you're trying to stay awake and you go to sleep. When you go to bed, you're trying to go to sleep and you stay awake. It's just too much wanting. So just sit here, you start nodding. Just make peace with nodding. And just see what happens. After a while, if you make peace with it, it just soon disappears. Or if you're in your bed and you can't go to sleep, just make peace with being awake. Because you know that your bed is probably the most comfortable place in this whole retreat. It's just so soft and cozy and nice. So sometimes, I remember once, I couldn't go to sleep one night over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And this is the method I used. I said, look, this is the most comfortable position for my body. I'm really cozy in my bed, a nice pillow, no aching legs or back. It's just so nice. What do I want to go to sleep for? I miss all this beautiful, cozy, nice feeling. So I said, no, I don't want to go to sleep. I just want to stay, you know, stretched out in this beautiful, comfortable bed with a pillow underneath my head, nice and cozy, nice and warm. So I said, no, I want to enjoy this. And as soon as I stopped trying to go to sleep, I was fast asleep. So it's just because you try to go to sleep. That's why you can never get to sleep. So use reverse psychology. When you go there, say, I'm not going to go to sleep. I'm going to meditate on my breath. Try that. Meditate on your breath in your bed. You go to sleep in no time. So that's what happened over there. But also, I mean, don't eat too much. You know, because that sort of doesn't really help you keep awake. There are, oh, the other alternative is sometimes it's vitamin deficiency means you keep nodding. Vitamin C, vitamin caffeine, cup of tea, cup of coffee. That sometimes helps as well. Dear Ajahn, that's vitamin C, vitamin coffee, vitamin caffeine. There are still some past experiences I can't let fully go. Probably I'm not accepting all the causes for my present being. This makes me feel guilty and my mind fighting my consciousness in the present moment. Sometimes you stir up the story about this huge truckload of shit. Could you please describe the process of digging in the shit in your garden a little bit more detailed? It's much better if you get a truckload of shit in the front of your house. The easy way is to move house. It's obvious. So it's had nothing to do with me. None of my business. So, what we mean, it's amazing. People get really giggly after a whole day of meditation. So yeah, he had a lot of problems there. But remember, it's just nothing to do with me. If you really feel guilty, what should you do? 50 strokes of the cat. You just walk over to Bodhinyana Monastery, find the cat, stroke it 50 times. If you still feel guilty, give yourself twice the punishment, 100 strokes of the cat. In other words, guilt will never be solved by making penances or making amends. Guilt will only be overcome by kindness and a bit of wisdom to realize you don't have to punish yourself. All that past, you know, which you're ashamed of, or which somebody else did, see, that's all dead stuff. It's gone. It's finished. And you don't have to keep carrying that around with you. Certainly not on a retreat. So, for those of you who are carrying around a lot of shit, you can do that visualization, which I teach at Nolamara. Just imagine yourself, you close your eyes, and imagine yourself carrying two heavy bags. Suitcases, shopping bags, I don't know what you wish to call them. Two heavy bags, and they ache. You know, it causes your arms to ache and your shoulders to hurt because you've been carrying for such a long time. This is imagination, okay? Visualize two heavy shopping bags, really heavy. Your arms are aching, your shoulders really hurt. And the one in your left hand, on the outside, it's got these four letters, P-A-S-T. It's your past, which you're carrying around. And the one in your right hand is your future. And they're really full. And they're heavy. And then you focus on the one in your left hand, which is your past. And you deliberately, slowly imagine yourself lowering that bag to the ground. When it meets the ground, all the weight disappears. And you uncurl your fingers from the handle. And you move your arm to your left side. It still aches, but it's getting better because it's resting now. It's not carrying anything. You haven't fully abandoned the past. It's down there. You can pick it up again later, but not now. This is resting time. And as for the future, all your worries and fears, that's all in the right-hand bag. So you identify that right-hand bag with your future. And again, you imagine yourself lowering it to the ground until that moment comes when it meets the ground and all the weight goes. Ah, your arm is free. So you uncurl the fingers, move it away from the handle, so your right arm is hanging loosely by your side in your imagination. Recovering, having that those aches, those strains, a time just to totally recover so your arms don't ache anymore. And you look down and there's the past, there's the future. It's quite safe, no one's going to take it away. You'll be able to carry it around later on, but now you're resting. So if you do that at the beginning of your meditation, a little visual exercise, you find it actually does help let go of the real past and the real future. Because you identify those two bags with the past and the future, you can let it go. And it's a useful exercise because people think, well, I can't throw it away. I've got some business with the past, business with the future. It's unfinished. Ajahn Pam says, let it go forever. You can't do that. Be letting it go temporarily for half an hour, for an hour. You do it temporarily first, then you can pick it up again. And after a while, you do it temporarily many times, and then you just, after a while, you put them down and walk away. you don't pick it up anymore. But do it temporarily, first of all. Then you don't carry around stuff. So that's what I say. That was not just a joke, just moving house. It means you don't own that shit. You don't own the house, so move on. It's not yours. Dear Ajahn Brahm, on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, when he entered upon the abode in the first meditation, his jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring, no bad words, with happiness, pleasure, boredom, seclusion. What exactly is meant by seclusion? Okay, first of all, these are the five factors of the jhana. So the first meditation, the first jhana, which is not accompanied by thinking and exploring. There's no thinking inside a jhana. Those words, vitakka vichara, it means the object of your meditation is bliss. Okay, it's a particular type of bliss, you know, for the jhanas. You know, the best bliss you've ever experienced in the world, much better than anything else you've ever known. It's incredible, powerful, beautiful, delicious bliss. And what happens in the first jhana, your mind has that bliss, but it hasn't let go 100%. It's 99.9%, so it grabs onto that bliss. It holds it. That is the vichara. A tiny bit of grasping left. So, because it holds on to that bliss, it's beautiful. You know, you're just into it. Because you're holding on to it, it becomes unstable. This is bliss born of letting go. You're just doing a tiny bit. And that means it's unstable. The mind moves away from it. But it's so beautiful, it attracts you straight away. You go straight back into it again. Going back into it again is the vitakka. You're still holding it, so you come out. It's a wobble. That's what I sort of describe it as, the wobble of the first jhana. That's the vitakka vichara. But it is subverbal. No way you can have anything gross as thinking in that first jhana. And as some of the monks, I think Venerable Analia, Samanera Analia, is a German monk. He's done a lot of work comparing the Pali suttas with the Chinese argamas. And you know, they're very, very similar. In most of the cases, the Pali is more accurate, but sometimes the Chinese is more accurate. And these were like the very early forms of our suttas, which were translated into Chinese. And so they give almost like a historical view of what those suttas were in, I don't know, maybe the 1st or 2nd century AD, or somewhere around that time when they were first translated. Could be a couple of centuries off on that, but no, very early on. And one thing which he found, when Ajahn Bhamali told me this, and it's an interesting point, this word vitakka vichara, it does mean thinking and pondering in other contexts. But in this particular context, it means something completely different. And in the Chinese version, whoever did the translation realized this and used totally different characters for vitakka vichara in jhana, vitakka vichara outside of jhana. Chinese words with a totally different meaning. Because they realized that the same word which is used for two things in Pali, they had two different Chinese words for their translation. So the vitakka vichara in the jhana does not mean the vitakka vichara outside of jhana. It's not thinking or pondering at all. That's very, very gross, thinking and pondering. So that is what the vitakka vichara is. And the happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. That's a great translation. The piti sukha, the bliss, born of seclusion from what? Seclusion from your body and its five senses. Vivicheva kamehi. Vivicheva is the same as seclusion from kamehi, the five senses. And again, as we were talking in the monastery recently, for those of you who are Pali experts, kamehi is a plural form. In a plural form, it always means the five senses. In the single form, it can mean sense pleasure. But in a plural form, always five senses. It's not secluded from sense pleasure. It's secluded from your five senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching is gone. And with it all sort of perception of your body. You're free of the body. And that's an important experience which you gain huge insights from. This is the pleasure, the bliss, born that your body is gone for at last. And no sense activity. That is bliss. And you don't need to be a rocket scientist to realize if that's bliss, all these seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, it must be a pain in the neck. It's dukkha, it's suffering. And this is a powerful point, because you realize even the most beautiful sight, the most inspiring sounds, even the most intensely orgasmic sort of feelings in the body are suffering. So when a monk comes along and says sex is dukkha, orgasm is suffering, people think, I am weird. I'm just weirder than a Catholic priest. Because you know what? They're in the news right now. I've been reading newspapers. You know, what are you talking about? You know, sex is fun. It's good. Yeah, but monks know something better than that. And when you get into these jhana realms, that type of pleasure, which is totally secluded from anything physical, that's such a greater pleasure. So compared to that, everything you can experience in the world is just pain in the neck. Which is where you start understanding Four Noble Truths. You understand what suffering is. You can't know that until you realize something far, far deeper and better than this five senses. And that's why we have monks and nuns. We leave the world, we leave the sex, the movies, the pleasures of which most people get into. You know, we're not sort of into seeing the birth of our first child. Not really into seeing the Great Wall of China or the Amazon rainforest at sunset or whatever else people really get into. Because all those five senses, we have a pleasure which is far deeper and more refined, compared to which any of the five senses, it just doesn't grab you anymore. So this is what it means, secluded from those five senses. And that's the bliss which happens. The simile is, again, just similar to the two bags. You've got a backpack on. And that backpack has got five rocks inside of it. And you've been carrying that around ever since you were born. The five rocks of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, your five sense pleasures, five senses. And because you've been carrying it since you're born, you got used to it. You don't realize it's away. It's always there. And then some Jojo of a monk comes along and says, sort of let it all go and get into jhana. And so you take off the backpack. Oh, what a relief. You know, you haven't got this great burden on you. You're free. And that's like why they say secluded from those five stones, those five heavy rocks which you carry around. That is bliss. So that's what we call just the reason why these jhanas are bliss. Experience it for yourself and think, goodness. Says, why did someone else tell me about these pleasures? First time I ever got a deep meditation, that was my sort of thought. You know, I was, many of you know, I was a student. Had a girlfriend, sleeping with her, and I just actually left her in Gloucester just to go on my first meditation retreat. So, you know, sleeping with her, and a few days later, get into a deep meditation. And I thought, I know what it's like sleeping with my girlfriend, and I know what this meditation is like. I'm not interested in your girlfriend. This is much better. It was actually better bliss, better happiness, and orgasm. So when I actually say these things, it's better than sex, I know what I'm talking about. I mean, it is better than sex. You don't have babies, you don't have relationships and all this stuff which happens with relationships. So it's much, much better fun. You know, just getting into this bliss of meditation. Are you interested? But you can't get it by wanting. You just have to let go and just relax and just don't want anything. Be content. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be calm, be gentle. And I'm just reinforcing it so you don't forget. And then you get these jhanas and they're really bliss. And that's what it meant by seclusion. Secluding from the five senses, from the body. They're just far away from you. Also, when entered upon the abode in the second meditation, which has internal confidence and singleness of mind. What does internal confidence mean? Internal confidence means it's a confidence of that sort of pleasure. So you've got that beautiful bliss. You don't have to hold it anymore. You've got the sort of the confidence you can totally let go. Because without confidence, you can't let go. As many people said in the interviews, and it's a great point, or even in the talk, in the questions, fear is what makes you hold on. Fear of what might happen if my body just disappears. It means you don't let it go. Fear of what will happen if I stop thinking. So you carry on thinking. So as I told one person, it's an old simile of mine. In meditation, it's like you're driving along the freeway, 110 kilometers an hour. You're the driver, and I'm the passenger. And I turn around and tell you, take your hand off the steering wheel, take your feet off the pedals. And you say, don't be an idiot, I'll crash. And I say, no, take your feet off the pedals, take your hand off the steering wheel, let go. And it takes the same amount of confidence when you're meditating to take your hand off the inner steering wheel, your feet off your wheel, and totally let go. If you did that on the freeway, you would crash and die. If you do that in meditation, you get into jhanas. That's what you have to do. And it's you have to go through that fear. I can't let go. Something will go wrong. So you do have that fear. And that remnant of that fear, that last smidgen of control, is the difference between the first jhana and the second jhana. So in the second jhana, that will is totally gone. Which is its how you can recognize it. So there's no will at all. Not even the potential to do anything. You're totally stuck. Nothing's moving. You can't do anything. And it's not because you don't want to do anything. You can't. That's just a weird state. And that is my reason why it is the fullness of samadhi. The first time when you really got stillness. That's why it is a pleasure and happiness born of samadhi. The first jhana pleasure and bliss is the pleasure your body's disappeared, totally. And the second jhana is because will has disappeared. And from that you get incredible insight. You get that enough. This thing called will, which you cherish, which you don't want anyone to take away, that is not yours. That is the biggest pain in the butt. Will. But you can't understand that until you get second jhana. So once you understand what will is, what craving, what desire, what choice is, you will never cherish it again and think this is something I have to cultivate. So if you get into second jhana, never again have the idea you can get into jhanas by cultivating will, by effort, by striving and struggling. Because it's this very striving and struggling is what you're supposed to get rid of. And it just disappears. And that's why you get stillness. The striving, the struggling, the very thing which agitates the mind, you've totally let go of. So now you are totally still and peaceful. So that's what that one means. And that's internal confidence. You don't have to do anything anymore. You're still. No more fear. Total. And mind you, though, much of you is gone. You hardly exist after that. Which is also why that sometimes you see in, say, the Christian mystic tradition or the Hindu tradition, some of those guys and girls get into jhanas, but what they say, it's union with God. So if anyone in this retreat gets into a jhana, you chose the wrong religion, you should have been a Christian, and then you'd be a saint. They'd name a school or a hospital after you, because you've had exactly the same experience those mystics said were union with God. It's incredible, powerful bliss, and you're not there. That's why I can understand that sort of a Christian with that sort of framework of understanding, they've disappeared. And it's powerful, incredible bliss, the most powerful bliss, sometimes you call it love, incredible, powerful love, bliss, is there, and you just merge with it. That one-pointedness. You've disappeared, and it's the most powerful thing you've ever known in your whole life. So people, if they look for a word for that, and if they're theists, they call that God. So, you could have been a saint, but you chose the wrong religion. Actually, it's much better, because that's just, you know, you stop at that place in those religions, you don't go any further. Yes, Saint Chris. Go on. That sort of thing, because you're not being such a big control freak. You're not sort of just controlling everything and telling people what to do and ordering things around, because if you control things in your life, you're going to control things in your meditation. So you begin to... Sorry? Yeah, work the other way. If you let go of meditation, you let go of a lot of things in life. You realize you don't need to be such a control freak. So, you know, I don't sort of control monks in the monastery. They're there because they want to be there. I don't tell them to get up in the morning. I've often threatened to have CCTV cameras in every hut so I can find out what the monks really get up to. But that's only doing that. That'd be really controlling them. So, you know, that's not my way. And that's because that's the way I meditate. So you don't control people. So if you can do that in your life, you find that your meditation is much easier. But you know, sometimes, you know, you're in this sort of the world, you have to do some things. And sometimes you might be a boss, you have to give orders. But, you know, just don't take them so seriously. And when you get into meditation, just this is your meditation mode. Switch over to letting go. And it all becomes nice and peaceful. Now, a nice deep question. If everything is cause and effect, how can I change anything? You can't, but I change it for you. I've been brainwashing you. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And how many of you, now when you're meditating, you hear these words coming up? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Where did those words come from? They didn't come from you, did they? You know they came from me. So I've been influencing you. So it's true. Cause and effect, you can't change things. So I change them for you. Which is why, even in the Theravada tradition, there is such a thing called transmission, like in the Tibetan tradition. Because it says that the only way that a person can actually understand the Dhamma is to hear it from another Aryan, someone who's seen the Dhamma. Because if you've seen the Dhamma, you can actually teach so other people can see it as well. Without that, you're just blind leading the blind, you get nowhere. So actually, this is how the transmission happens. And so, you know, you get someone like an Ajahn Chah. So when he teaches, you know, it's something powerful there, because he's experienced something, seen something. So all the teachings which I give, it's not my fault. I'm not responsible for them. If anything wise I say, it's because I was conditioned by Ajahn Chah. And you can't blame him either, because it was his teacher, Ajahn Mun. You can't blame Ajahn Mun because it was his teacher. So the buck goes all the way back to the Buddha. He's at work on this retreat. And even the Buddha, where did he get his teaching from? That was from Kassapa the Buddha. If you look at the Gatikara Sutta. So it all goes back. So there's this great transmission of the Dhamma. It's to call it like the wheel of the Dhamma just moving. And this is how it happens. So you can't do it by yourself. So the cause has been put inside of you from listening to others. And because that cause is there now, that's why I like to teach, to put the seeds inside of you. So unfortunately, for many of you, it's too late now. You've been conditioned enough, you won't be able to give up meditation or Buddhism. Maybe I'll put it aside for a little while, but unfortunately it's too late for most of you. So you're going to leave the world sooner or later. Sorry about that. And it's nice, if you really understand that question, it's all cause and effect, I can't change anything. It's so true, so stop trying to change things. Let it be. Stop trying. It's a totally impossible thing to do. So if you're trying to get jhana, it's impossible. I've told people, I go on record, I can't meditate. I can't meditate. I can't get into jhana. I have to disappear first of all. If I try and do it, no way. So I can't meditate. When I get away, meditation happens. When I disappear, jhana just happens. But I can't do it. That's why I said I can't meditate. Do you understand what I mean? You can't meditate either. There's no person in this room can get into jhana. You disappear, and then jhana happens. Remember what I said? The path, not what I said, Buddhaghosa. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but no person who enters it. That makes it quite clear. Anyway, aha, somebody had a look at one of the suttas, which I recommended to them. The one fortunate attachment, it's actually one fortunate night. It is he, the peaceful stage, was one fortunate night. Two questions. Is the fortunate night present moment awareness or jhanas? It's present moment awareness. Because that particular sutta, it says something like a bad ending of the past, a bad ending of the future. You know, so it's like, shows you just being in the present moment. It's not actually attachment, because it could have meant attachment, it could have been night. But I think if you look in the second edition of the Majjhima Nikaya, that, you know, people research that it does mean one fortunate night. Just staying in the present moment, just one great night, that's all you need to become enlightened. You don't need many, many times. So it's just one great night. When you let go of the past, let go of the future. Totally. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I am a bit confused. Yeah, just get rid of the iron, get rid of the confusion at the same time. Yesterday you said that generally, I knew I'd get into a problem with this one. Yesterday you said that generally women have an easier time than men getting into jhanas, but have more trouble figuring out what the experience means. But this morning you said that insights are a natural consequence of jhanas, i.e. they develop automatically. Then what is the figuring out that needs to be done, and how is it done? It just takes, it's a natural course, but it just takes longer to grow. Just like some trees take longer than others to grow. So of course they're growing, but they might take a bit longer. But don't worry, because the trees which grow very fast, they usually fall over very fast. The trees which grow slower, they're the ones which have the stronger pith inside their core, and so they grow slower, but they're much, much stronger. So if you're taking a long time on this retreat, even to get to the present moment awareness, you're going to be very, very strong. All these whiz kids conceited up their backside meditators who get into jhana on the first day, just they're going to fall over very quickly. So be slow, patient and strong. That's only an exaggeration. But that's actually what happens. Okay, so usually the speed to get into jhana, the time is quicker for women. But then they linger as a cause and effect eventually leads to wisdom, but guys catch up. And that's just a gross generalization. I knew I'd get into trouble with that one. Ajahn Brahm, regarding the gender question, oh no, again. I seem to find more ladies seeking to evolve spiritually than guys. For example, in this retreat, ladies easily outnumber guys 2-1. Do you see this in your retreats or talks elsewhere? That's usually about 50-50 most times. Maybe a few more women than men. But I don't know why that is. Why do you think that is? There's plenty of men here. Well, I don't know what the numbers are. So maybe I think it may be because women are much better on the computer than get the rooms before the men do. I know some of them are much better just asking me, Ajahn Brahm, can you please get a place for me? Can you please go? Yeah, go on. I think 42 women to how many men?
16 minus 42.
Only 18. But some of the women here, they're very, very masculine. I'm going to get into trouble for that one as well. I'm going to leave that one alone. The more I explain that, the more trouble I get into. Can you please say something about nuns' ordination, other gender one, and 10 precepts ordination? Why was the other monk excommunicated in Thailand? Was it for ordaining just 10 precepts? I thought the Theravada bhikkhunis were usually 10 precepts. No, the Theravada bhikkhunis are 311, isn't it? Yep, there we got it right. 311 precepts. So the novice, the samanera, is the 10 precepts. And, you know, actually the rule in Thailand, you know, the rule which I was supposed to break, I never broke it. Because the actual rule says that a monk cannot ordain a samanera, in other words, be the preceptor for someone giving 10 precepts, or they can't be the preceptor for a bhikkhuni. And of course, you know, I got out of that on the loophole that Ayatathaloka was the preceptor, not me. So, but I think Ajahn Gan actually gave the 10 precepts to his nuns. So that actually was technically breaking the rule. But it's such an old rule. It's only like an edict from the Sangharaja in 1928. And a lot of people say it's got no legal justification because it hasn't been passed in law. It's just the saying of the top monk 80 years ago. Yeah. No, this is another sort of controversial one. Because first of all, the monks did ordain bhikkhunis. But then afterwards, he said, no, just let the bhikkhunis ordain bhikkhunis. So there's two choices. And because the Buddha actually never abrogated that rule, he never said, don't do that anymore, there is an argument to say that the monks could actually ordain bhikkhunis. So, according to the Vinaya, there's a strong argument for that. But, I mean, in the end, I mean, just, if it wasn't even a law, the Vinaya, the law put down by the Buddha, takes precedence in that particular case, and it's quite clear that you can do this. And also, it's quite clear, ethically, it's the right thing to do. So, ethically, legally, precept-wise, you know, we've got all our ducks in line, so it's okay. It's just, you know, sometimes people get a bit upset that you find the loopholes and do it. So anyway, it's all done, all legal, and can't be touched because I've got a good lawyer. Next question. Is there any recommended mantra for sitting meditation? One like, I will die, that's for sure, for walking meditation. Yes, there is. In Thailand, they use Buddho. Breathing in, you say Buddho. Breathing out, Tho. Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. For Westerners, especially in Australia, that does not work. They haven't got the same faith and feeling for the word Buddha. So for Australians and English and United States, Americans, Westerners, and even for Singaporeans who've just been educated in the Western system, or Penangis, or Sri Lankans, who else is here? Or Vietnamese, or Canadians, or Germans. Anyone else? Who's that? Who? New Zealand, yes. When you breathe in, you don't say Bud. As you're breathing in, you say the word to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up. Along with your breath, shut, up. Shut up. Shut up. Don't laugh, it actually works. Because after a while, you do shut up and stop thinking and writing stupid questions. Next question. The path of meditation, the more that disappears, the more peace and happiness there is. Allow stronger faith in Nibbana, Anatta. So it's a waste of time worrying and being scared of Anatta. Instead, we should just indulge in meditation. Thank you. Exactly. Well done. Don't get surprised. Whoever wants to claim this question, I'll shave your hair. I'll give you a robe. Exactly. It all fits together. That, you know, when you let go, what you're actually really letting go of is of your will and your choice and wanting to control things. And that is the majority of your sense of self. It's one of the great sayings of the Buddha. You know, it's very short. Wherever there is a self, there is something which belongs to yourself, your possession, your ownership, what you attach to. And what you attach to, that's what you control. So whatever you attach to, whatever you think is yours, use that to find out what the self is. Because that's what the self does. It owns things. It attaches to things. What it owns, attaches, it wants to control. So as you let go of controlling, you let go of things you think belong to you. body, nothing wrong to me. My past, that's not mine. So I don't want to control it with anger or guilt. Guilt is controlling your past. See, let it go. So no controlling more past. Just be whatever you want. You just don't worry about it anymore. So your past is not you, your future is not you, your body's not you, your will is not you. What's left? Hardly anything at all. And because that's not you, you don't control it anymore. Do you control me? Do you tell me what time to get up in the morning, what to do? Of course you don't, because I don't belong to you. But why do you tell your body to do this and do that? Because you're under the illusion that body belongs to you. Therefore, you can control it and tell it what to do. That is your problem. So when you realize the body doesn't belong to me, it belongs to nature. You just let nature take over. Gets up, whatever time it wants to get up, let it get up. If it wants to go to bed, let it go to bed. Nothing to do with me. That's why one of my other mantras, which I use, instead of shut up, is none of my business. None of my business. None of my business. A thought comes up, none of my business. An imitator comes up, none of my business. See the Buddha, none of my business. So just, everything just disappears. It's none of my business. Just like somebody comes to you in work with some sort of question. None of my business. Go see someone else. Or they come in there with a phone call. It's not for me. None of my business. Isn't that wonderful? So meditation, none of my business. Nothing is your business, because there's nothing there. And that way you totally disappear. And then, so you understand what anatta is, what disappearance is. And everything disappears and vanishes. Gone, gone forever. Bye-bye. Yes. It is. That's what builds it up. Desire and attachment build a self. From craving and upadana, you create more life. And the selfish goes with it. You let go of craving, let go of doing, controlling, owning, no attachment. You don't exist anymore. It's like being a monk in Australia. Sometimes you have to apply for a new passport and they want identification. And you've got to have all these points. So they ask you for your driver's license. Haven't got one. Your tax number. Haven't got one. Your marriage license. Haven't got one. Your rental agreement or your, what's it called, when you get a mortgage agreement. Haven't got one. Your bank account. Haven't got one. Credit card. Haven't got one. You don't exist. In Australia, monks are just on the edge. They're so invisible. Because we haven't got all these things which define you. So sometimes it's very difficult to actually to apply for things like passports. I remember once I was applying for something and they said, we can't give it to you, you haven't got enough ID. But I was fortunate because I still keep my old British passport. I had two passports and they just made enough points to get me identified. Otherwise, if I had just one passport, I'd have vanished. So it's great being a monk because you don't exist. So that's actually what you own defines you. But when you don't own anything, you're not there anymore. Yes. Are you still there? Okay. With attachment, yes, what you're attached to. And as you go into deep meditation, your attachments, you drop them one by one. And then you get to the difficult ones. Your body, why is it people can't get into jhanas? One of the reasons is because it's too attached to your body. Why do you keep getting disturbed by sounds? Because you're attached to listening. You can't let go of hearing. And one of the reasons why is that's your last line of defense. In the morning you wake up to an alarm. You know, if you're half asleep, they shout at you, because hearing is what protects you. You wake up, you hear the burglar, you hear the ghost, you hear the tiger in the forest. This is what protects you more than anything else. That's why to let go of hearing is scary. If you go into deep meditation and your hearing goes, you don't know who's going to creep up behind you with a machete. Who is going to put their fingers in your purse and take all your money away? People get concerned because, you know, the hearing is a protective mechanism. But you don't have to worry, because meditation, you just get so invulnerable. So you can actually let go. But it's because of fear, attached to the body especially, you can't let go of hearing. It takes a lot of trust. And I'm supposed to give you that trust that everything will be okay. So that when that happens, you find out what your attachments are. And then it's so hard for many of you just to let go of willing and controlling. You're attached to will. To let it go is difficult. That's why just before you get into the jhana, there's a scary moment. You know, it's almost, I say, you're like on the edge, and you can see just bliss beyond your wildest dreams, literally. Just so much bliss. But you notice to take that last step, you have to let go of something which is so close to you, your body and much of your will. Sometimes you're too scared to do that. Just like the child who's never been in a swimming pool before. He's so afraid because he's never been in water before. It knows dry land, that's what it's attached to. So it takes a lot of courage and guts to get into jhana. You come across this barrier of fear. Fortunately, the bliss is just too strong. So what usually happens is, I'm scared, oh, what the hell, I'm going in. So that's usually what happens. Anyway, wonderful metta again today, with the ladies being a very special dharma to supplement Bianca's TLC. A very contented customer. At least her stomach's contented. May their mind be contented too. Ajahn, I am a little worried about coming under attack from a black sorcerer. Any tips by way of protection of the Bhamiharas in meditation to protect myself? Yeah. I tell that story that I was visiting my mother in England, and she was making my dana, my lunch for the day. Now, when you only eat one meal a day, as I was eating in those days, your lunch is very important. So when somebody rang her doorbell, I say, Mother, I will answer it. It was just so that she wouldn't spoil my lunch. So I answered the door. And at the door was this gypsy lady, which they have in England. They go round door to door selling trinkets. And so the gypsy lady said, would you like to buy a gypsy charm for good luck? And I said, no, thank you. I was very polite. And then this gypsy said, if you don't buy this charm, I will put a gypsy curse on you. That's what she told me. Because actually that's their marketing campaign. And then people are so gullible, they just buy something because they just don't know, and I don't want a curse on them. But I was a monk. I was in my robes. So I stood up to her and said, don't you realize I am a Buddhist monk? And my curses are much stronger than yours. And I was just being Ajahn Brahm's cheeky and just messing around. I shouldn't have done that, because the lady, her jaw dropped, she turned around and she started running. She was really terrified of me. I never put, so if you see a black sorcerer, you say, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a meditator. My sorcery is stronger than yours. Which it actually is. So the sorcerer will just disappear. So the sorcerers, they're afraid of meditators, because your power is much stronger than theirs. So if you see a sorcerer, look them in the eye. I am a meditator. I am a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. Oh no, no, I didn't mean it. And they'll run away. So you've got much more power than they have. Yep. Yeah, go on. Okay. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hierarchy of power. The folks up in the northwest, the Yamajis, they seem to be like the kings or the highest power of the Aboriginal cultures. And what they say, knowing well the fact that one is associated with good forces in that area, but there are other sorcerers from other tribes.
Yep. Yeah. You'll be fine. I mean, one of the things which makes you strong is five precepts. Sila. Never underestimate the power of that. That's number one. And number two, just the power of your mind. Because if you're a good person, a virtuous person, your mind gets far more powerful than any of the sorcerers, anywhere from whatever sort of tribe. One of the stories which makes this very clear. One of the old Thai ladies, many, many years ago, she married a Westerner, moved to Perth. And she, after a while, she brought her mother. You know, her father had died, so her mother was not alone in Thailand. She brought her to stay with her in Perth. One day, obviously, the mother got very sick, was in, not Prince Margaret, KPMH, King Edward the Memorial Hospital. You know, it's in the women's hospital there. And so she was there for a while. The doctors weren't really sure whether she would pull through or not. So she went to one of these spirit doctors. And asked the spirit doctor, you know, can you find out if my mother's going to survive or not? So the spirit doctor cost you $20. So he gave $20 over and she went in her trance, get into a mind-made body. And she actually asked, what's a hospital? You know, King Edward Memorial Hospital, the ward, the room number. So she went into a mind-made body, her astral body, and she went to the hospital, then she came back again, and when she came out of trance, she gave the $20 back. And said, why? Well, no. And she said, look, I don't know who your mother is, but, you know, I went to that hospital, I found the ward, I went to the room, I just could not get in the door. I've never seen such a force field around your mother. What the heck has she been doing? I've never seen that before, said the spirit doctor. And she called it a force field. She's an Australian lady. And the tiger said, oh, my mother's, she's a Mae Chi, an eight preceptor. She's been, you know, ordained for about 30 years. And I think at that, the spirit doctor took the $20 back. You should have told me before. People like me can't get close to people like that. And that's just one story amongst many. Those precepts, they give you, in the psychic world, a force field, which these people just cannot penetrate. And that really strengthens your mind psychically. If you've got any weaknesses in your sort of virtue, then, you know, those powers, they can sort of get in there through those cracks in your virtue. But if your virtue is pure, you're sort of invulnerable. If you start to meditate, your power increases manifold. So that's, you know, if you get into that sort of stuff. But those people who do use psychic forces to do evil on other people, oh, they're really going to suffer big time. Because, you know, that sort of power just magnifies just the bad karma. So, basically, if there are some people up in the Northwest doing that sort of business, I wouldn't like to be those sorts of people. It's going to come back on them big time. So, keep your precepts, you'll be totally... Yeah, just normally keep your precepts all the time. Nothing can harm you. You're far more powerful. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for the very inspiring Dharma talk this morning. Going through the process you described in my morning's meditation, that was a prolonged period of time when the sensation of the heart beating overpowered the sensation of the breathing. What should the focus be at this point in time? Thank you, Ajahn. Yeah, that's somebody else asked me that in interview time. That sometimes if your heartbeat gets very powerful, and then you can't really, that's like a dead end. You're going down one of these one-way streets, which no through roads, because you can't calm your heart down. Because then that goes very, beating softer and softer, and then it stops. Then you're in big trouble. So usually just take the attention away from the heart and back to the breath. And again, the heart only becomes prominent when you get excited. So just calm down, relax. Don't get so excited or so afraid. Then your heartbeat will just, you know, won't be part of your perceptual field anymore. So if it does happen, try that sort of the idea of the screen. Put the breath in the center of the screen and the heartbeat's on the edge somewhere. Don't put the heartbeat in the center of your screen, otherwise it will stay there. Put the breath, you can feel the heartbeat, it's over there somewhere, but the breath is in the center. So after a while, the heartbeat falls off the edge of the screen. It's not there anymore. If the people that experience spontaneous or flute jhana, like the lady in Penang or Rockingham, hear the Buddha's teachings on dukkha anicca, wouldn't they instantly get it, either Dhamma, like those people in the suttas? They certainly get a lot. Remember that lady in Rockingham? She started coming to a monastery and offering dana. She really got into it because she had a deep experience. And, you know, the Buddhism, the monks were the first people who could actually explain it to her. She said, wow, you guys really know what you're talking about. And no one else could. So that gives them a lot of faith that, you know, we actually understand this nature of the mind and these things. But, again, they have many other things. I mean, that lady in Rockingham, she had a young kid. And, you know, I think she was single. So she was trying to find a partner, looking after her kid. She had so many other things that, you know, she got sort of taken away, you know, with, you know, the worldly concerns. So even if a person does fluke it, yeah, for those few weeks, months afterwards, they get really interested. But sometimes, if it's only one, after a while it wears off. They never forget it, but it wears off and they go out in their world, they do their things. But later on in their life, they'll come back to it again. For the person who asked about Q&A compilation, the talks are recorded so you can get them later at BSWA or download online, hopefully. Oh, isn't it wonderful, the internet? The trouble is, though, you have to go through all of these questions to find out the one you really wanted. So if you'd like on sorcery, I'm not sure how it works. Can you actually just, on the question and answer, click in sorcery and just get the search and find the sorcery? Or would it be actually blocked by the black magicians? I don't know. Anyway. Dear Ajahn Brahm, instead of hoping for nimittas and jhanas, should we actually be focusing on letting go in our meditation and daily life? Or letting go and be peaceful, kind, gentle and loving? Exactly! Don't focus on the jhanas. If you want jhanas, you'll never get them. But if you focus on making peace, being kind, being gentle, then the jhanas come to you. So that's all you need to do. That's what I said a few days ago. I feel like a fool. What I should have really did is the first talk, was it Thursday night? So make peace, be kind, be gentle. I'm going to shut up. And it's all up to you from now on. However, sometimes people want it all fleshed out. So for the last few days, all I've been doing is fleshing out, making peace, being kind, being gentle. That is what meditation is all about. So just do that. So don't aim for jhanas, don't aim for nimittas. Just aim to make peace, be kind, be gentle. In every moment. Then jhanas will happen. So Ajahn, is there a particular reason why caves are sought after by meditation teacher? I've seen in India, many of these cave niches are so small. Just like my hut, where I live, is a cave. And it's small as well. And the reason why it's small is because you don't have to spend so much time cleaning it. Imagine you had a cave like this size, this huge mansion of a cave. It's just too big. So the best caves are just small enough to sit in, lay down in. Enough good air, but you don't have to spend all your time cleaning it. So those are the best caves. Too big, it's just too many problems. Too small and you can't lay down or sit down. But just right, the Goldilocks cave. Not too hot, not too cold. Just right, they're the best. So these tiny small caves, they're the best. So, I like caves. And you know this Buddha actually is called sometimes the jhanas, the cave of the heart. He called Hadaya Guha, the cave of the heart. Because as you go inside these jhanas, it's like you go into a cave inside of yourself. Beautiful, peaceful. And you can't feel the body and all the sounds and senses. Just like some of those caves I used to go in Thailand. Inside, you couldn't hear what was going on outside. So you're totally away from the world. And, you know, it was dark and black, so you couldn't see anything. It was silent. It was a great place to go to because it was sensory deprivation. Your five senses just disappeared. And instead you had this beautiful sixth sense of the mind. So caves are neat. How to remove fear. You're going to die anyway. So the sooner you do it, the better. You know, get it out of the way so you've got nothing to fear. So what are people afraid of anyway? So how to remove fear? One of the best ways of removing fear is be in the present moment. Because all fear is about something which might happen in the future. And whenever you have the perception of the future, with the perception of the future comes the uncertainty of the future. And with the uncertainty of the future comes fear. Who knows what's going to happen? There could be a monster waiting outside this hall, waiting to pounce on you. What are you afraid of? So, in the end, if you have no perception of the future, all fear disappears. In today's talk, you mentioned that enlightenment can only be achieved after attainment of jhanas. Does this mean after the attainment of all eight states, or just after attaining the first four jhanas? One's enough. Just get one jhana. And then the possibility is there. But the more jhanas, the better. So, you know, it's like how many tickets do you need to win the lottery? Just you need to have at least one ticket to win the lottery. But if you have many tickets, then you increase your chances. So if you have more jhanas, it increases your chances. But one jhana is enough to win the lottery of existence, the lottery of samsara. Out for life. Also, when does one then undertake the practice of insight investigation? Or is it that once you attain the jhanas, insight is automatically gained? Yeah, it happens automatically. You can't really stop it. Sometimes people get jhanas a few times and they're sort of a bit slow. But really, you've got all that incredible energy. You've got all the data there. But what really helps making sure you get insight is having a good understanding of Dhamma. Having heard things like Anicca Dukkha Anatta. Having heard the teachings from another enlightened being, an Arya. And they say those are the two factors of becoming street winner, seeing the Dhamma. Yoni Samanasikara, what I say, going into the source, the jhanas. And the other factor is Paratagosa, the words of another, meaning the words of another enlightened being. You get those two together, the words of an Aryan and the jhana. It's like the match and the gunpowder. The match is the jhana. The gunpowder is the teaching of the Buddha. Bang! And you're enlightened. There we go. It works. So you need those two factors together. So if you've got the match but no gunpowder, in other words, you get the jhanas, but you haven't heard the teaching of the Buddha, like those Christian mystics, they miss it. You've got the teachings of the Buddha, you know, passed down the line of Aryans.
and you've got the jhana, and they come together. Ah, now I understand what anatta is. Now I understand what this wheel is all about. Now I understand what, you know, the Buddha was talking about. Because you've heard it before. Now you get the jhanas. They come together. And that's powerful stuff. So these days, people have heard the teachings of the Buddha so many times. So you've got enough gunpowder. You've got whole arsenals of gunpowder. You just haven't got a match. So just get those matches. Ajahn, I've been on the meditation path for 34 years, and though still not enlightened like Ananda, still find long sits, etc., much easier and get more happiness in the early days. I believe this is due to going through, doing it tough, sitting through pain, up at 4 a.m. and so on, just like I guess you did in Thailand. No, I got up at 3 a.m. 4 a.m. is for softy cream puffs. 3 a.m. was for the real meditators. That's why he didn't get enlightened. He didn't get up early enough. So I wonder how effective your gentle and nonchalant teachings are for beginners. They don't have to waste 34 years if you do it the gentle way. It's actually very powerful. Because sometimes all that hard stuff which I did got me into some very bad habits. One of the bad habits, like doing these all-night sits, which I used to do, of all the Western monks, I'm not just doing this to sort of praise myself, but I did it more diligently than almost anybody else. So, but all that really taught me was just how to endure sleepiness. And these days I thought that was a stupid way of, I'd have made much more progress if when I was tired I would have taken a rest. I remember one monk, he's an abbot of one of the monasteries in England, I won't say who it was, he decided to sit through pain. Sitting down there, he had to have a double knee reconstruction as a result. This is stupid stuff. Sitting through pain. What was the first teaching of the Buddha? Middle way. Atta-ganamatanu yoga is one of the things to be avoided, and that's sitting through pain. It's Atta-ganamatanu yoga, 100%. And people still do that and think they're going to get somewhere. And they're just following the path of the Bodhisattva, not of the Buddha, the one who's sort of 6 years of doing that. So it makes you tough, but it also gives you this incredible strong ego of controlling. You think you can just push through things rather than understand things. One of Ajahn Mahabua's stories, one of the nice things about being a monk in Thailand, you went to visit all these great teachers, and every now and again, they would just give a talk every 4 or 5 days, and you wouldn't know when, you'd send a couple of monks around to everybody in the monastery, talk tonight. So he gave a talk tonight. It was for me, because I was visiting. So he said, this is for the Western monk. And he told this story that when he was with Ajahn Mun, Mahabua, he wasn't Ajahn Mahabua yet, he had malaria, like most forest monks did. And when it came to 3 p.m., which is the time you do chores, mostly sweeping, the bell went for 3 p.m., and he was in the middle of a fever. And he thought, no, I'm going to fight that fever. And he forced himself up. Went outside, took a broom and started sweeping in the middle of a malaria fever. And he's one tough monk. And he was telling me that what happened next, Ajahn Mun saw him. You stupid Mahabua, you stupid monk. This is not what you're supposed to do. You're not a Buddhist, you're a Hindu. That's what you are, you're a Hindu. That's what he called him. He said, Hindus fight, Buddhists contemplate. So you go back into your room and understand sickness. Stop trying to conquer it. And I remember Ajahn Mahabua said this. And he said it in Thai. And I understood that Thai perfectly. And then it's obviously Ajahn Mahabua didn't read my mind. Because he said, translate it to the Western monk, pointing to me. But I understood it perfectly. And I've seen a translation of that because it was a great talk published in Ajahn Mahabua's compilations. But it misses the power of the Thai. And the fact that there was Ajahn Mahabua sort of blasting himself, being self-critical, because his teacher told him that is the wrong way to practice. He's a tough guy, he could do that, but that's not the way to do it. So you don't fight. You understand, you contemplate. That's the path of Buddhism. Yeah. It was actually that
as Westerners, we were stupid. Because when they did this, they said we should all stay up at night. Most of the Thai monks went to bed. And only the Westerners stayed up. Well, the thing is that when Thai people say things, you know, it sounds to us that this is a rule. But for Thais, it's only an option. Now, we just don't get it. It takes years. Like, for a good example, they had this big discussion once about taking snuff. You know, this snuff you put up your nose, and it became like a fashion for the monks. Because the Buddha never prohibited it, absolutely, you know, the monks started getting into it. So they had, I mean, it was really crazy. They had these, like, U-tubes, and you know, they had the fat end to blow through and the small end, you know, where you put your snuff in. And, of course, the monks turned it around because they'd get more snuff up their nose. They're blowing their eyeballs off with this stuff. And so it got so gross, they had a big meeting of all the monks, and they decided, you know, should we, shouldn't we? Was it not prohibited in the vineyard, but it's a gross thing to do, and we shouldn't be doing this. And so they all agreed, yes, it's prohibited from now on. And as soon as they prohibited, then the meeting was over, and Ajahn Liam, the head monk now, as soon as the meeting was over, he was sitting on the stairs there with his snuff, putting it in and blowing up his nose. And we thought, this is really crazy. We just passed a rule. You know, we can't do this. And that's actually the Thai way of doing things. It takes a lot. It's like a cultural difference. You know, the rules are there, but, you know, just in case you really want to apply them, but they don't have to be applied. And there's a few Thai people there. That's Northeast Thai. And so, you know, you didn't get it at first. So, you know, we sort of said, oh, we all stay up at night. And they were all sleeping, and we thought we had to stay up. So actually, that's a Thai way of... It's a tough one to understand. We have to be there a long time to understand it.
And what about smoking?
Oh, that smoking, yeah. I mean, that's... It was Ajahn Chah used to smoke, and then someone said it was bad for his health. He said, oh, really? I said, okay. So he gave it up straight away. Yeah, it was, yeah, it's not against the rules. But even though it's not against the rules, it's not so obviously a good thing to do. So that's why that in Wapapong now they passed a rule. You can't smoke. And I'm sure quite a few people do smoke. So this is actually the way. If it's in the vineyard, that is a rule. You've got to keep it. But if it's not in the vineyard, it's very hard to enforce. Staying with the pain, but sometimes if you stay with the pain, it doesn't dissolve. Remember, pain is often nature's way of telling you that there's a danger there. So, you know, if you get a pain in the knees, you know, that sometimes it's saying that there's a danger there, so move. You know, the pain of fire, make sure you don't get totally burnt, you move away from it. So much pain there is for a purpose. So because of that, it's a very dangerous technique. Sure, it does change. And then sometimes you can sort of, it gets so bad in the end, you just do let it go. You take away the mental doubt, and then you get this great insight as what pain truly is. But it's much better to sort of avoid the pain in the beginning and get very powerful, peaceful mind states with a comfortable body. And that was the Buddha's discovery. He tried the pain method 6 years and found it didn't work. And then he gave up trying that ascetic type of practice. And as soon as he gave up that, his five friends thought, you've just given up. You're a softie, you're a cream puff. You're not a real monk anymore. You're not seeing through pain. You're not staying up all night or whatever. But he knew what he was up to. And so he became enlightened that way. And when he went back to see his first five friends, they rejected him. They said, you know, how can you become enlightened when you haven't been really practicing hard? Seeing through pain, enduring difficulties. You're getting fat, you're eating milk rice prepared for a deva, sitting in nice places, bathing, you're indulging. And that's where he taught the middle way. There's this fine line, beautiful, where you're not hurting your body, you're not indulging it. And you know that because that makes your body just so strong and peaceful, you can get into deep meditation. You don't fight your body. You just look after it, be kind to it until it disappears. So that is the path of the Buddha. So sometimes people come to me, many people come to me, victims of vipassana. Because they've done that and they've really screwed their head up, and sometimes their body as well. I mean, people who've got psychological problems because their mind has been not that strong like most people, and they go through the pain, they have to sit there, and that does create a lot of psychological problems. They're victims. So it's a dangerous one. As a psychotherapist, you can understand that's too much force. Sometimes so much force breaks people. Some people survive and they get something out of it, but they're victims as well. Kanchana? Yeah. Yes, there was, before the tape, that last night you decided to forego much of your sleep and just put some effort into the practice, and just to walk and sit, and then eventually when you decided to go to bed because you were physically shaking from that sort of effort, you were hard asleep at first, but then you watched your breath and fell asleep and went into a very deep sleep and felt okay in the morning. That sometimes the willpower can give you quick results, but long-term problems. So don't just judge it by the quick results. As I said, you can use willpower, and you can actually get quite deep in meditation, but only so far. And then you'll come across a brick wall you just cannot go through, because you've gone on the wrong path of exerting will, control. It's getting into a bad habit. So it might work, like taking a cigarette makes you feel better, or taking a glass of whiskey. Oh, that gets rid of my aches and pains, but you get into bad habits. So I wouldn't do that. Usually, that if you detect a pain in your body, it's actually that usually, like a pain in the knee, for example, it's much better actually to move. The movement means that you lose a little bit of your mental stillness, but you soon get back to where you started from. But more importantly, in the movement, you're developing this beautiful sense of kindness. And it means that development of kindness will mean that you'll be much easier to settle the mind with kindness. And you'll find by developing that ability in the beginning of the meditation, that force, that will really help you get into deeper and deeper meditations. Well, apparently you don't, you don't really keep moving. If it's really that uncomfortable, you go and sit on a chair. Because most people, they can sit on a chair and watch a movie for 2 hours and they don't have to move. So it's not really physical, really problems. If it really is a physical problem, then move. as far as the main problem is the restlessness of the mind. That keeps people moving more than anything else. And that restlessness is overcome with contentment and kindness. So this is why that developing the kindness, developing the ability just to be gentle to your body, by developing that with your body and moving this way and that way at the beginning, out of kindness, out of gentleness, you find that makes the mind very peaceful. And soon it is that peaceful mind which creates that physical tranquility, the kaya prasadi. It's important to understand that the tranquility of the body, kaya prasadi, in the suttas is preceded by pity, by this joy. You need to have that joy before the body can be tranquil. You don't get it through force. Yes. The only time when the Buddha was really forceful when he was talking about Devadatta, and that was so out of character, that was brought up in the questions of King Milinda. So now this was out of character. Why did the Buddha act so forcefully to Devadatta, when to everyone else he was just, you know, the great compassionate one, and very kind. So anyway, I'll just finish his last three questions. It's almost half past, so no more questions from the floor. If any sort of comments, you can actually ask them in a piece of paper, because otherwise I'm not being kind to you because some people are getting sleepy. I read somewhere the Buddha spent the morning on metta meditation. Is this true? Why metta and not jhana? I don't know, and I don't think he actually really says that. I'm not quite sure what he was doing in the morning. But remember, to do jhana, you have to do metta as well. Remember what I said at the beginning? If you can't do anapanasati, do breath meditation. If you can't do breath meditation, do metta meditation. If you can't do metta meditation, do loving kindness meditation. If you can't do loving kindness meditation, do letting be meditation. So basically, metta leads to jhana anyway, so it's all the same. I've been on a meditation. Oh, I've done this one already. That's right, ah, good. So we've only got one last question. Dear Ajahn, you really know how to run a good retreat. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Isn't that always save the best till last. So there we go. Some satisfied customers. So be kind to yourself. If you force yourself, you get tense. And that tension, you can't really get into deep meditation. Just to finish off tonight, you know the story of the man who went to the psychiatrist's office? And he said, "Doctor, sometimes I think I'm a marquee. Sometimes I think I'm a teepee. What's my problem?" And the psychiatrist got it straight away. "Sometimes you think you're a marquee, sometimes you think you're a teepee. I know your problem, you're too tense." Okay, go to sleep. See you in the morning. Okay. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.